Welcome to Built, Wired and Secured, the podcast where we explore how modern buildings are designed, connected, and protected in the real world. I'm Alex Morgan, and in today's episode, we're diving into designing physical connectivity to avoid single-point failures, why it matters, where projects usually go wrong, and what decision-makers need to understand before problems show up in production. Joining me today is Michael, and together we'll break this down from a practical, real-world perspective.
Imagine an ordinary Tuesday during a renovation. A contractor is rerouting a concrete pour, a backhoe nudges the wrong conduit, and suddenly a building, the whole building, loses connectivity. No internet, point-of-sale systems stop, access devices hiccup. Tenants call the front desk, and the front desk has no email. For 2 hours, everyone is blind. That actually happened. Names and places removed, but the consequence was real. Today, we unpack how a single cut like that happens, and more importantly, how you design so there isn't a single cut to begin with.
From an operational standpoint, that scene is our worst short-term nightmare. Tenants feel this immediately. Lost revenue, frustrated staff, and scrambled manual workarounds. I remember walking a floor while alarms were going off and thinking, what breaks if this goes down? That question drives everything we do after the fact.
Before we dig into fixes, let's frame why this matters beyond an angry tenant email thread. A single-point failure in physical connectivity doesn't just cause aesthetic inconvenience. It affects business continuity, safety systems in some cases, and can balloon into expensive emergency work. Michael, tell us about the kinds of systems you see impacted first when a primary service entry fails.
Typically, the immediate impacts are pretty predictable. Tenant networks and phones, cloud services tied to local circuits, sometimes access control if it's networked, and building management systems that rely on that connectivity. The trick is that some of those impacts are visible to tenants, and some are silent, like backup monitoring going dark. That mix makes triage messy.
Okay, let's move into diagnosis. When we talk about why a physical path fails, what root causes do you see again and again?
4 things come up constantly. 1, undiversified entry points, everything coming through the same manhole or the same riser. 2, mixed tenant risers, where multiple services share spaces and a single contractor action affects everyone. 3, undocumented splices and handoffs, those invisible joints that no one can trace quickly. And 4, simple coordination failures. No common schedule, no clear demarc, and everyone assumes someone else is protecting the path.
Undocumented splices. Let's be careful here and not get into technical how-to on splicing. But at a high level, what makes those splices such a recovery pain?
Sure. At a high level, it's about traceability. If you can't quickly identify where a service actually changes hands or where a splice lives, responders spend hours hunting instead of restoring. From an operator's point of view, that time is the difference between a short outage and a rolling escalation, where tenants call legal and IT calls emergency vendors.
That leads us into design trade-offs. Diversity is the obvious answer, but it comes with cost and complexity. How do you balance that in a real-world capital plan?
You balance it with risk appetite and impact analysis. If a tenant's business model depends on constant connectivity, you justify separate entries and even separate carriers. For facilities that can tolerate short outages, you might accept shared conduits, but build operational compensations, clear patching procedures, faster vendor SLAs, or on-site spares. My rule, design the pathing to match the value of what it protects.
Let's talk specifics. You can call out in drawings and RFPs without getting into pricing or legal terms. What are practical heuristics? Things teams can demand in design reviews to reduce single points of failure.
A few heuristics I use. 1, require at least 2 physically diverse entry paths where feasible, separate manholes or separate utility routes. 2, separate tenant risers when tenants have critical services. Shared risers for low-impact systems only. 3, label and document every handoff in the drawings. Who owns the cable from point A to B? 4, insist on visible demarcation points in accessible, labeled enclosures. These are low-tech but hugely effective.
And on the subject of demarcation, clear ownership matrices are vital. In your experience, what does a useful ownership matrix include?
At minimum, the physical segment description, the responsible party for maintenance, emergency contact for that party, the last known vendor or carrier for that segment, and expected response times. We put that on a single sheet diagram that lives in the facilities office and in the cloud. When something breaks, you shouldn't be guessing who to call.
Now let's move to operations and recovery, because good design only helps if you can restore quickly. What are the operational playbooks you recommend for carrier coordination and rapid restoration?
First, pre-established escalation paths with carriers, specific names and phone numbers for emergency restore, not general support lines. Second, periodic cutover rehearsals or tabletop exercises, so everyone knows the sequence. Third, emergency spares staged on-site or nearby. Fourth, standardized labeling and a simple documentation packet, maps, splice records, Demark photos that technicians can use immediately. From an operational standpoint, rehearsals and documentation reduce a restore from hours to tens of minutes.
I want to give listeners something they can use at the next design review. Michael, walk us through three physical inspection checkpoints they can do right now and five carrier coordination questions to ask.
Three inspection checkpoints. 1. Trace the physical entry from the street to the building. Verify there are at least two independent paths or document why only one exists. 2. Inspect riser rooms and confirm separations between tenants and critical systems. Check labeling. 3. Open demarc points and confirm visible, legible labels, plus recent photos in your documentation packet. 5 carrier coordination questions. 1. Who is the emergency restore contact and what's their escalation path? 2. Where are your splices and do you have as-built maps? 3. Can you commit to a response time for emergency cuts and is that written? 4. What are your cutover and scheduled maintenance windows and how will we be notified? 5. Do you provide physical route diversity or just logical redundancy?
Those are excellent. To close out, give our listeners three practical next steps they can take in the next 30 days to reduce single point failure risk.
1. Run the three inspection checkpoints across a few representative buildings and document findings. 2. Create or update your ownership matrix and attach it to the building drawings. 3. Schedule a tabletop exercise with carriers, IT, and facilities to walk an outage scenario and confirm escalation contacts. Small, repeatable steps produce big gains.
Perfect. For listeners who want tools to act on this, we've put together a carrier coordination checklist and a restoration playbook template on the Built, Wired, and Secured Resource Hub at GDS Technology. Download them, adapt them to your buildings, and use them in your next design or operations review.
And remember asking, what breaks if this goes down early in a project saves you much more than a late-night emergency restore. From an operational standpoint, those conversations pay dividends.
Thanks, Michael. That wraps our episode on designing physical pathways that don't break. Visit the Resource Hub to grab the checklists. And if this episode helped you, pass it to your facilities or IT lead. Built to last, wired with intention, secured for the real world.